Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts hold something of the word you want to speak to us this day, God, the word we need to hear. We trust you, our God and our Redeemer. Amen. All of this Lent, we have been immersed in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, probably the most important sermon he ever preached. We've just glossed over it, really. We could spend more weeks and even months mining it for meaning. There's a word in Hebrew, dayenu. It means it would have been enough. And that is perhaps true of this one sermon by Jesus. If this were all of Jesus' teachings that were left to us, it would have been enough to change our lives. Dayenu. John read this morning just a bit of four short stories that ended this sermon. Stories that Jesus told in rapid-fire succession, each similar enough to carve deeper into the same space, and each different enough to suggest that their lesson can be applied in many situations. There are two gates, he said, as he began the first story. They open onto two roads. One is broad and smooth, well-paved, easy to travel, like a highway. The other is narrow and rocky. It goes uphill, like a mountain path. Not very many people choose this one, but the narrow path, the one that's hard to walk on, is the one that leads to life, he said. There are two different kinds of trees, Jesus said. Both look good, all have green leaves and stand up tall, but one produces luscious fruit, the other something as poisonous and prickly as a thistle. You have to wait for the right season to know, but then you will see that only one of those trees produces something good to eat. It's the fruit that matters, not the shiny green leaves. The same is true with people, he said. Credentials and even good intentions don't actually matter much. What matters is what you do with what you've heard and experienced, how you live. People who listen to me, he said, to any wisdom, fall into two camps. Either they hear and do something in response, or they just let the words wash over them. Sometimes you can't tell the difference until storms come in, as they always do. When rain and floodwaters come, when the wind is buffeting your house from all sides, then you will see which person has built their house on a solid foundation and which house is built on something that washes away like sand. With each of these stories, Jesus framed a pair of images, a pair of choices. He seemed to be saying, you have to choose one way or another. One direction to set your face when all other direct destinations are possible. One way of living your life in contrast to all the other choices out there. You don't just have to choose, he said. You do choose. Every day, conscious or not, we make choices about who we will be. Even when we think we have no choice, when we say, I'm between a rock and a hard place, we choose which of those we will lean against. We can't always make what we want happen. But even in unwanted circumstances, we choose to face toward what is life-giving or what is not, toward healing our own brokenness, toward hope or despair. We choose who we will be, even in the middle of circumstances we did not prefer or not create, circumstances we cannot control. Viktor Frankl, the Jewish philosopher whose thinking was shaped by his experience in the Nazi concentration camps, said that the power to choose is at the core of our humanity. Everything can be taken away from a man or a woman, but one thing, he said, the last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Frankl chose to love rather than to hate as the consequence of his experience. He could not defeat the hatred of the Nazis, but his choice kept their hatred from defeating him. What we choose changes us. Maya Angelou was speaking in San Francisco once when she told a story about a time when she'd been there 10 or 15 years earlier, putting on a public television show about African art. Just before the show was supposed to go on, she got a call from a stranger who said that he had a collection of statues from Africa, and maybe she would like to use them for the show. So she went and she saw them, and they were perfect for what she was doing. She used them in the show, and she and the man who had lent them to her began a friendship. In fact, Maya Angelou got to be quite close to this man and his wife. They had dinner together a few times before she went back to the East Coast. A few years later, she came back to the Bay Area for something, and she called this man, her friend, and said, "Hello, it's Maya Angelou. I'd love to pick up our friendship and to see you again." The man said, "That was great." And as they talked on the phone, he began to tell her a little about what he had been doing. He'd been in Europe, working with the problems of American troops who were stationed there. "How did it go?" she asked. He said, "The black troops have a particularly hard time because they are black and there aren't many blacks around. But our boys also..." She interrupted him. "What did you say?" she asked. He said, "The black troops have a particularly difficult time for various reasons, but our boys also..." She could hardly believe what she was hearing. She knew this man wasn't hearing the impact of his own words. And so she asked again, and they went through the same thing a third time. All of a sudden, as she described it later, the man heard himself, what he had said, and he said to her, "This is the most awful thing I have ever done. I can't believe I said such a terrible thing to you, Maya Angelou, talking about the black boys and then our boys." She said, "No, this is why we have to talk to each other, because that's just what racial prejudice is. It's hidden. Whatever is said on the surface, underneath is that deep, ingrained sense of a difference you feel between black boys and our boys." So they continued the conversation, and they agreed to get together. And then over the next weeks, she tried many times to get a hold of him, to see this man and his wife. Again and again, her calls were not answered. She left messages and got nothing back. And finally, the whole friendship just fizzled out, and years went by. She told this story during a two-day conference she was speaking at. She told it at the end of the first day in response to a question about where she still saw racism around her. And as she told the story, she got visibly upset. The next morning, she came back to the podium. And first thing she said, I'm sure you noticed that I was moved by what I told you yesterday about how I experience racism. But a remarkable thing happened as I was leaving the hall last night. A man in the audience stood up and said, "Here I am." It was the man she had been talking about. And as she said this out loud that morning to the whole hall full of people, the man himself got up out of his seat. He was a small white Episcopal priest, and he walked up to the platform and he threw his arms around that great big black woman, Maya Angelou, and they hugged one another and they wept. The whole audience was silent with emotion. They were moved because they saw right in front of them all those barriers: race, fear, mistrust, misunderstanding, loneliness, all those barriers that confine us and that are so hard to get past, being crossed over. That story is about the choices two people made, the choices we all make, sometimes consciously, sometimes not. The white man chose to step out of the darkness where he sat, if not comfortably, then at least anonymously. Maya Angelou also chose to forgive, to wrap her arms around someone who had hurt her, to keep trying to find a lost friend. They both chose relationship over pride, over principle. We cannot always choose or control what will put us in a dark place. It might be illness or our own shame, feeling hurt, a situation that feels to us terribly unfair. We often feel unpowerful over other people, even over our own lives, but we never lose the power to choose. To choose the direction that we will set our eyes and our hearts toward life or death, forgiveness or hostility, hope or pessimism. Toward the road that has become familiar and easy, or toward a God who will just never leave well enough alone. You choose the road you will walk on before you know what experiences it will bring you. That's what we do when we are baptized or when we become a member of a church. We say, "I choose this direction for my life," and to walk toward it with this community of people. It's not always an easy choice. Choosing one direction means, by definition, leaving another. Sometimes it doesn't feel practical, or maybe even possible. It has always seemed a little bit slippery. A 12th century mystic who must have known something about real life said once, "If you can't love God, then start by loving the people who love God." Every week, I stand here and urge you to choose to follow the way of Jesus. Not because there's some line that you must put your toe on to be acceptable to God. Not so you can help me build a better church. But because I know this path to be one that can lead you to life, to healing, even to joy. There is a prayer that speaks of the power of our choices. I invite you to pray it with me. What we choose changes us. Who we love transforms us. How we live reshapes us. So in all our choosing, O God, make us wise. In all our loving, O Christ, make us bold. In all our creating, O Spirit, give us courage. In all our living, may we become bold and whole. Amen.